Hey, cashiers. We Have the Receipts podcast is coming at you live from Netflix is a Joke Fest in Los Angeles.
Chris, are you kidding?
No, Netflix is a joke, Courtney, but this is not one of them. Our listeners in LA have the chance to join us for a live recording of our podcast, We Have the Receipts, hosted by me, Chris Burns.
And me, Courtney Revolution.
Join us and a few surprise guests from your favorite Netflix reality shows on Saturday, May 4th at 1 p.m. at a secret location in Hollywood.
To be announced.
Get your tickets for the We Have the Receipts live show at tudum.com/WHTR. That's Tudum, TUDUM.com/WHTR.
Tickets are limited. If you can't make it to the show, we still want to hear your beautiful voice. Leave us a message at speakpipe.com/WeHaveTheReceipts.
You may even hear your own voice on the show.
Grab a ticket at tudum.com/WHTR.
And we'll see you on May 4th in Los Angeles. Bye, cashiers.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and this is You Can't Make This Up. You Can't Make This Up is the podcast where we uncover the true stories behind your favorite Netflix documentaries and films. On today's episode, we take a closer look at the Netflix documentary series, The Program, Cons, Cults, and Kidnapping.
I keep thinking after all these years of looking into it, you'll get to the bottom of it. There's just more and more and more, and you just keep finding out more characters, more connections, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Today, we're talking to director Kathryn Kubler. Like hundreds before her, Kathryn Daniel was sent by her parents to a school for troubled teens. The Academy at Ivory Ridge claimed to use therapy and recreational activities to help its students. Instead, teens suffered mental and physical abuse in a program that operated like a cult. Years later, Kathryn and her former classmates rummaged through the files and videotapes left behind in the abandoned school. Their goal was to come to terms with what happened to them within its walls and hold those responsible to account. The Netflix documentary series, The Program, Cons, Cults, and Kidnapping, is a gripping look at the so-called troubled teen industry from the point of view of those traumatized from its practices. It also explores the company whose business model is to keep parents paying huge fees while their children suffer horrors at the hands of their school's staff.
For them to be isolated like that in captivity and told that their parents don't care about them, it's really setting them up for some real disaster.
And I'm joined now by director Kathryn Kubler. Kathryn, welcome to You Can't Make This Up.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So there's a lot of conversation in the journalism world about like who has the right to tell someone's story, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any question that you have the right to tell this story. So did you approach this story with that in mind? I mean, you also brought a lot of other survivors along with you. So how did you think about that?
Yeah, no, it's funny because for a long time, I really did not want to include my story because I like to be a private person. Like I'm more comfortable behind the camera than in front of it. But I just wanted to get people to know about this industry. I was really wanting to make a documentary about the issue as a whole, the systemic issue. And, you know, I was pitching around to 2010, 2013, and no one was biting. And everyone's like, why do we care what happens to a bunch of rich white kids? And I was like, no, it's more than that. Then fast forward to finding my own file in the building. And I remember walking through the building and finding like more of my stuff, like several copies of my birth certificate and all this stuff. And I was just like, oh, shit, I'm going to have to be in this documentary now, aren't I? And my husband had been telling me for years. I met my husband in film school, and he's come along with me this whole way, kind of sneaking in, like, undercover into places and filming. He's like, I'm telling you, do your own story. And I was like, I don't want people to think I'm a narcissist or, like, whatever. And I also was just legitimately was like, my story isn't that bad, honestly, compared to so many other stories I knew. But I also knew that, like, it's crazy that after years of researching on this issue and trying to expose and trying to find any evidence, that it would be my very own program that left all the evidence just sitting there. Like, it's I just had to get over it. I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to just tell it the way I would tell it. And if I'm going to tell my story, I'm going to bring along other stories with me because I don't want to be this one person. Then people just attack that one person. I was like, I will use my story as the narrative thread to bring these other stories along with me and just be this guide to kind of go down the rabbit hole And I know all the people that can speak to other aspects that I didn't personally experience, but I know they did. So I was just, I'm very grateful to have all of my friends just come along for this crazy ride and be so vulnerable and just do all this ridiculous stuff. So couldn't have done it without them.
Don't you think it's important, though, that you had all this footage of yourself from before you went into this program, because you're able to bring so many receipts of your own experience. Like, you're able to say, like, I was a really good kid. And then you show footage of yourself being a really good kid. And then you're like, I had a really crappy relationship with my stepmother. And you have footage of that. Like, that's important to your story. And it also brings, like, some, like, for lack of a better word, like, levity to this story.
Absolutely. And it was funny at one point talking to like my agent producers, I was like, I don't want to say you should make the documentary about me, but like you probably should make the documentary about me because I have this tremendous archive. And because I had all my letters from the program, I mean, I just had so much documentation. And with the very difficult challenge with doing a story like this that's set so far in the past in a very controlled environment is not having access to a lot of visual media to help, you know, say something that you just don't have. And then it was crazy. We found the security footage as well.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, I just, as you can see, I just filmed everything growing up. So I had so much footage. That was just something I always did. But what's interesting is that was me before the program. I was always a ham for the camera and always in front of it. And then post-program, it's hard to find too many pictures of me because the trauma, you know, I was just so dissociated from my body at that point. It's still very hard for me to see myself on camera in the dock.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess it's just years of not being able to look at yourself in the mirror or talk that you just exist in your head only. And so I prefer being this disembodied voice in the voiceover. And that made me more comfortable with being able to tell the story and script the narrative and be okay with doing it.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to like put you in a place of that makes you uncomfortable, but I'm just curious, you know, when you were sent to the academy at Ivy Ridge, you were gooned. I mean, that's a term where teens are, you know, basically just taken from one place and brought to another, transported for intake. Do you remember that experience? Like, what do you remember about it?
That is one of those like light bulb moments that you'll never forget. Yeah, I remember it. And to be honest, like I didn't have the worst kind of experience. Like I had a pretty, I don't know if there's like a good way to get kidnapped, but like I had it pretty mild. And when it wasn't like, it was just confusing because it was during the daytime and it was at school. And so it seemed like official things. Most kids, however, are taken in the middle of the night and have a much more traumatic experience. So I'm lucky that I didn't have it that bad. But I had one friend that got taken in the middle of the night, and she even had a friend spending the night that night. So the friend was traumatized as well. So it's just like, so you think you're being kidnapped because what else is happening? And so you're shouting out for your parents to come help you. And most kids look over and just see their parents standing there silently watching this all happen and allowing it to happen. So really just the event of being taken to these programs is a lifelong trauma in and of itself that you can just never really come back from.
So you've been attending this Christian prep school in Stony Brook, Long Island, where you were suddenly pulled out and then sent to this quote unquote school. Were you immediately struck by the lack of actual, you know, schooling at this school?
I mean, I think that was the least of my concerns there as the lack of schooling. And see, that's always something like I try to like steer people away from of looking at this place as a school because it just was not on any level. And it's easier for people to say, oh, it was a boarding school. It was absolutely not a school in any way, shape or form at all. It was a prison. It was worse than a prison. I remember when Orange is the New Black first came out and I watched that and I got so angry that they had more freedom in prison than we did in the program. Because I'm watching the show, I'm like, they could watch TV, they could talk,
they could get haircuts.
Yeah. They could have a cup of noodles. I would have killed for a cup of noodles. Like, oh my God. So they had us do all our like self-led schoolwork on this Bible-based computer homeschooled program called Switched On Schoolhouse. And everything was like multiple choice. And there was no one to teach you. So you just take it over and over again until you get it right, because they wouldn't let you move forward until you got an 80% or higher eventually, because it's multiple choice, you just learn all the answers. And so you just take it. And usually the correct answer is Jesus. And but our parents don't know this. So all of a sudden, they're just like, wait, Catherine's doing well in all of her classes. Because, you know, I'm like a solid C student. Like, I'm smart, but I just don't apply myself.
Yeah.
And so now they're like, well, wait, she's getting A's and B's and everything. Clearly this place is working. So parents are getting this artificial sense of security of like, hey, this place is finally working. She was always getting in trouble at her old school or, you know, struggling in math, which I still am. And when I actually went to college, it was very, very difficult because I legitimately had no real high school education.
Right, right. So as you mentioned, the documentary does start with you sort of exploring the building, the academy at Ivy Ridge. And yeah. It looks like the rapture happened there, right?
Yeah.
I have a lot of questions. One of them, you know, and you can fold this into your answer if you want, is the property still owned by the company? And were you as stunned as I was that like literally everything was just left behind?
Yeah. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Like what? It was just walking into like a crime scene. It was literally like a time capsule. And yeah, it's like haunting and decayed, but is finally like represented of like what it always felt like there.
It's like The Last of Us, right? You guys are walking around.
It was nuts. And then, you know, talk about having trouble coming up with something visual for a documentary. All of a sudden we had this like amazing set design that like you couldn't get anywhere else. We're like, and it was just like this labyrinth as well. Cause keep in mind, hundreds of kids are living their entire lives within this building, not able to leave. So it was very, very haunting and wild. As far as ownership goes, no, it is not still owned by the family. After Ivy Ridge was shut down in 2009, I can't remember exactly what year, but they eventually sold it to this Chinese businessman. He had plans to open it as like a school for international students, but that never materialized. And so it just kind of like sat there. And this same businessman bought up several other properties in the area that nothing has really happened with. It was just was there decaying for years. And actually, I will say I can't take the credit for being the one to discover it because actually my friend Sean, who's in the documentary. So Sean tried to get Al Jazeera to write an article in 2013 about the building being left with all the files. And we just like didn't cross paths, Sean and I, at that time, because I was working on this doc from 2010, 2013. 2013, I started working at Paramount Pictures and I just kind of got so busy with that work that I just kind of left the program stuff aside for a bit. And I was like, you know what? I tried. I did my part. No one's greenlighting this. I'm just going to move on with my life. I didn't hear about the Al Jazeera stuff or the building until much later when Molly reached out about my file.
Yeah. And it was still there. I mean, not only like your records, your schoolwork. I mean, you found an essay that you wrote about yourself.
Yeah.
What was that like? Like reading that essay, revisiting your past self in your own words?
The amount of coincidences, you can't make this up. Seriously. It's crazy. Because like that's finding a needle in a haystack. Like if you saw that room, it's like that weird corridor that was just thrown with piles of files on the floor and papers and everything strewn about in no organized manner. Some of it was like water damage and it was all gross and moldy. The fact, my friend Molly, again, finding all the best stuff, she's like, Catherine, look what I just found. And you see the scene in the doc. That's me seeing it for the first time. So this was my first share.
Yeah, I found my first share too, separate from these.
Okay. Catherine Daniel, real mom died of breast cancer. Yep, that's always my introduction to people. Before I was two. Oh, this is like my words. Had a lot of nannies. Dad remarried at age 7. I was really happy. Then it started turning horrible. There's so many times I was turning to my friend Molly throughout this project. I was like, no one's going to believe us. They're going to like, because.
Staged.
Yeah, well, because if you know in episode 3, sorry to jump around, but this was another crazy thing, is when we found that there was a seminar going on in the hotel we were staying at.
That was crazy.
And when we saw that, both Molly and I, we just were cracking up and we're just like rolling on the floor laughing, crying, and we're like, no one's going to believe us. This is so crazy. So, but yeah, as far as finding that first share, it was wild, but it's so validating to see these things because you're like, yes, this did happen. This is all here, this is proof. It's so hard to describe. I'm still processing all of it.
So there seems to be like a lot of spontaneous things and a lot of things that just like, as you said, the school becomes a set piece. It becomes a character in the doc. And one scene that really stands out is Quentin's.
Yes.
You talk to him in a room that he used to be sent to as punishment. Was that just like an in the moment decision to set that scene that way? Did he decide to do that? Did you decide to do that? How did that come about?
Yeah. So a lot of the stuff, I mean, I wish I had planned things better. Quentin, we knew he was going to tell the story of the riot. And so he gave us the walkthrough of that. And that was really cool because that was my first time actually knowing what had actually happened, because on the girl's side, we were shielded from that. There was just so many scenes throughout the movie that weren't planned, but by being in that space, it just happened.
Like, I don't want to feel what I felt here. I don't even want to be here right now, but I'm here. I really don't want to be here right now, but I'm here. I'm fucking weirded out. I'm uncomfortable. I'm shaking, like...
Well, fuck this place.
Yeah, fuck this place.
Yeah, we always knew we wanted to film Quentin there, and he was down for it. So we did not force him there. And I always worry that when people see that scene, that they'll think that I was, like, forcing him to, like, do this. And I was like, no, absolutely not. I never wanted, you know, everyone went into this willingly and doing it. But then again, being there just brings back all these memories and floods of things. So I, you know, that moment of having to remind Quentin, like, hey, you don't have to be here. Like, let's leave now. And so it was just a really empowering moment of being able to walk out together and realize we're not trapped there anymore.
I mean, I get the sense, like, with Lex's story, it did seem really spontaneous. And I get the sense that you knew about the story, but was it different hearing her tell it, knowing that she was telling it to the world?
Yes, I was actually very surprised she said it, because we had discussed amongst us before, like, okay, what are the issues we want to talk about? What are the things we do? And we all knew about this one staff member, and we're like, we have to expose her. But you also don't want to force people to talk about something they're not ready to talk about. Everyone's still dealing with this and coming to terms with it. But I was so surprised she said it, and I didn't know what to say, because I could tell she, like, something was happening. I was like, I don't know too. I'm just going to. So I just, like, let it happen. We all just kind of stood there and just let her kind of process. And it was a really beautiful and vulnerable moment. And I know she has so much, you know, anxiety about all of that. But what I hope, even though are never able to really name this person to avoid a defamation lawsuit, is she does such a great job of explaining the methodology of the grooming process.
Right.
And so it doesn't matter what the person's name is, in a sense that so many people will be able to identify with the pattern of behavior.
The love, the withdrawal, the love, the withdrawal, yeah.
Yes, yes.
And then you see her do that to other people. Sorry, but you see her do that to other people, so you're like, what did I do wrong? Like, how did I fuck up? You know, like, I was just starting to be loved by this person, and now they're looking at somebody else. So then the next time she calls you in and wants to take it a step further, you're like, please, please, like, please touch me. You know, like, please show me this, like, love and affection, because I don't have it.
I think it will be helpful to a lot of people to get that kind of validation and to understand that process as well, because it's something people really don't talk about too much.
I'm curious about something that you mentioned earlier. You talked about the discovery of all these security DVDs of, mm-hmm. you know, kids being assaulted, physically assaulted and abused. You are the documentarian here. You have to go through all of the footage. And I also know that you're an editor, right? So you have to go through all of the footage. How much of that did you have to sit through and absorb? I mean, was it just hours and hours and hours and deciding, like, which abuse scene do I put in my documentary?
Right. I mean, well, luckily, whoever compiled the security footage that we found, it was already edited to the most abusive moments.
Why?
So that's the question. We're like, why did they have this stack? Because it wasn't just like, oh, here's a bunch of security footage, watch through all of it and find the most abusive moments. It was already cut to the most abusive moments.
So strange.
And it was just in a stack on someone's, like a staff member's desk. So we're like, okay, was someone, were they keeping it as what? I don't know. But it was like, thanks for doing all the hard work for us, because here's all the, you know, cut to the, like, the highlight reel of the best abuse at Ivy Ridge.
Yeah.
So there's a scene in the doc when we're all in my office here and we're like, let's put in the discs and let's see who's on it and see if who we can identify. And immediately it's just the most horrific stuff you can see. And there's a lot, like, we didn't put all of it in there, but there's a lot. And everyone is just, you know, immediately shocked and horrified.
So this is going to be a restraint that takes place. You're not doing it good enough or something. Oh, jeez.
While he went down.
While he went down, he just... What was the kid doing? I don't even see the reason for it.
There was no reason.
There was no reason?
No. He was not doing fitness well enough.
Yeah, it was hard seeing it, but it's also very validating because we all knew this stuff was happening, but we never thought anyone would believe us. Because keep in mind, we're all being written off as bad kids and liars and manipulators, and we're going to make all this stuff up. So I'm so glad that there's video proof of it happening, because you can try to describe the stuff. No one's really going to believe it till they see it.
Well, I think one of the reasons it's really powerful, I mean, you do revisit this small town in upstate New York, right? Mm-hmm. And you try to interview former staff members, and there are variations in the theme, and you do talk to some of them. And you describe this place where there are, like, very few jobs, right? And some of them say, you know, they thought they were going to work at a real school, and then they get there, and they kind of got with the program because, you know, they're doing what they're told. They're doing a job in a place that aren't that many jobs. You've seen these videos, and then I'm watching you talk to these people, and sometimes you just seem very open to hear their stories. What was that like for you?
I mean, essentially, it's the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Right.
And so it's like these well-meaning people, well-to-do people who would never think of being an abuser, never think they would be in that situation. Look at what the Stanford Prison Experiments did and Stanley Milgram's experiments. If people are put in the right circumstances and told by authority, like, no, this is what you're supposed to be doing, the kids need this, they will do that. Now, the Stanford Prison Experiment was shut down after like 5 days for being too abusive. And that was by willing participants that were adults. Now, these programs replicate the Stanford Prison Experiments every single day on children during the formative years of their brain development. So the psychological effects are extremely damaging. But looking at it from the staff perspective is they don't go into it be like, I'm going to beat up some. I mean, some probably did. I'm going to go beat up some kids. But others, they just find themselves in this environment just following orders. You know, it's not, it's never been a good excuse, but it works and that happens. And so it really corrupts people.
Yeah, I was sort of watching like on the chart, like the shame/contrition matrix. The lines didn't really seem to cross much. Like, you know, there was like, I'm sorry that happened. But it was never like, I did that and I'm sorry I did that. It was a very a series of kind of strange conversations. And the conversation in the church was especially interesting.
Oh my gosh. So my producer was so stressed out during that one. Poor Rachel Liebert. She's the best. Kept her on her toes the whole time. But yeah, that church thing, that was something all my friends and I really wanted to do, but like our legal team and producers were like, I don't know. But because he was a pastor at church, we had a little bit more leeway. And I was like, let's do this.
So how do you feel about that now? Knowing that a lot of parents were conned out of their money to send their kids to a place like Ivy Ridge where
First
they were
of all,
abused.
If this is going to only take us 6 minutes to exposés, then frankly, I'm not interested in getting involved.
Okay. Bye. Thanks.
Thank you.
Happy Sunday.
So after we do it and we come out, and we go back to our Airbnb, my producer is like, can I interview real quick? And so I sit on the stoop, and this is an interview you see in episode 3 where I start crying and stuff. It's one of the few non-voiceover moments for me where I'm actually talking to the camera. And she's like, can you explain why you did what you just did? Because that was like wild. And I was like, sure. I was like, you know what? I don't feel bad because they literally trained us in attack therapy. This is what they taught us to do, is to confront people and yell at them and tell them what a horrible person they are and do all this stuff. So if he can't take 10 minutes of that after just being up in a pulpit on Sunday morning, it's like, we know what this guy did. That pastor, we found so many emails from him. That guy, oh, he's lucky we don't reveal more in the talk, but he's one of those people that knew what he was doing. And so I really just had
not a lot of regret about that conversation.
I was like, this needs to be exposed because this is a man who was the one running the whole PR and marketing, putting all these pictures and presenting this whole facade, knowing what's really going on. I was surprised he admitted to, because I asked him the question, I was like, do you think the pictures he took of Ivy Ridge were representative of what was actually going on inside? And he said no. So he knew, but he also was not willing to talk.
That's right. Yeah. So the business model of these schools doesn't work without parents, obviously. And in your documentary, you sort of point out they are the customer for these programs. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about those customer retention tools that the programs use?
Yes. That essentially is the business of the program, is keeping the parents paying and keeping the children there. And so as we're going through all these files, I mean, it's so helpful because we are understanding how everything was at play. And it did help me get, you know, more understanding for how deeply manipulated my father was. The main role there to keep the parents are these family reps. And when we get there, we think the family reps are there to help us. Because they're our one contact with the outside world with our parents. And so we're like, hey, tell my parents this is a mistake. Like, get me out of here. But then when we go through all the files, we realize the family reps were incentivized to keep us there longer. And their whole job was really just to keep the parents happy, keep them signing up for seminars, keep them sending their checks. When you think about when you're paying to send your kid somewhere for help, you'd think that there'd be someone taking care of the kids that's dealing, especially as a place that advertised themselves as a therapeutic boarding school. What is the therapy we're getting? Right. Because the person that's dealing with us as our main person is our family rep. They're not helping us. We had 5 minutes to talk to them once a week so they could have enough information to give our parents something about us. But yeah, there was all these tactics, like they would call our parents every single day until they signed a commitment letter to the program. And so the parents would sign this whole thing saying, I'm committed to program completion. And they're like, you can't pull your kid out earlier or else they're like a half-baked cake. You know, all the progress will be undone. So it's just all of a sudden you're on a different timeline. Because with a regular school, you have, summer break comes up, you go home. You don't have that timeline there. It's like, no, the next seminar, the next level. And so all of a sudden you're there and time has flown by and it's been a year and the parents are happy because their kid that was trouble at home is now somewhere else that they don't have to worry about it. And my parents were empty nesters then. So they didn't. Yeah.
Well, you know, you brought up your dad and you know, your storyline with him is a big part of the documentary. And you are in the documentary. You know, we watch you still sorting out your feelings toward your father for having sent you there and more pointedly for leaving you there for 15 months. And we hear that you decided to cut him off for that same amount of time, 15 months. Now, at this point, you're an adult. So was there a buildup to that idea of, you know, estranging yourself from him for this long period of time?
Yeah. So when I first got out of the program, I got pulled a few months before I turned 18. And there's that fear of being sent back. So you just kind of bide your time. But the day I turned 18, I bought a car off Craigslist for $350, got an apartment with a program friend with some Lithuanian guy she found on Craigslist, and I started delivering pizzas. And I was like, goodbye. And I just was gone. But then in that first year after the program was a really dark year and is for most people because we're learning how to readjust to society. But then I was like, you know what? I don't want to let the program derail my entire life more than it already has. So I'm going to try to get back into this kind of indoctrinated bubble I was in before the program because all my friends are going off to college. And I was like, I need to go to college. I don't want to be delivering pizzas forever. And like, I could barely survive. I was like, I would actually sneak back into my dad's house and steal like milk and cereal sometimes just to like live. And I was like trying to get enough like gas money to buy like a bean burrito from Taco Bell or, you know, just to get to work or do something. So I was like, let me just like try to get back. So I kind of made up with my dad enough so that he would pay for college because I was like, you owe me that because I didn't get a real education. And so I was like, I just need to like cut off and like start with a blank slate and just figure out life because I've been so indoctrinated in so many ways and my whole worldview's shattered. I need to deal with this. And so I started by being like, okay, 15 months because I want him to feel. I was like, he's just not understanding. I don't think he fully understands. And you can't heal until someone like fully understands something. So it started as 15 months and then 15 months came. I was like, I'm still not ready. I'm still mad. And so I kept moving on with it. But then when the documentary happened, they're like, well, you need to interview dad. I was like, I don't really talk to him. I'm not really comfortable. And so it was very raw and it was very hard for me to have those moments with my dad. You sent me away to a place where I was vilified and told I was the problem. I was a kid.
I didn't know they were going to do that.
You wrote in your letters. I can read them back to you.
You know what? That's something you and I are in agreement on. Those programs, and this is why I'm with you on the programs, they manipulate parents. And once, I'm so sorry, Catherine. I am so sorry, sweetie.
And I don't want it to feel like this, like it's all good because it's not. These programs literally destroy families. Relationships aren't going to heal. It's not going to be this magical thing at the end where it's like, oh, and we're all good now because we're not. You'll never heal from it. But luckily, you know, my dad has been such a good sport about all of this. He's seen all the episodes and he's like, this is so good. This is great. And he's being very vulnerable. And he's a very sweet guy. He's just been very, very manipulated and You know, so props to him for going along with it. But all the stuff with my dad is very raw and real. And I have a lot of anxiety about it because, why, of course.
Do you think including him in the documentary and like putting that stuff on camera has, you know, helped the process at all? Like, you know, I'm just curious about that because, you know, as somebody with an estranged parent, I know how hard it is to have these conversations, even the email, right? It's like you see the email hit your inbox and it's like, nope. And you had this conversation, this very difficult conversation on camera. But then we see you later in the documentary. He's sitting with you telling you how proud he is of you. And I'm just wondering how it's going and whether or not this film itself like helped.
Yeah, it did really help. I mean, it was rough, but we had to deal with this stuff because what is the other option is just kind of like bottling it up and pretending, sweeping it under the rug and pretending it didn't happen, and that you're not going to have a real relationship if you do that. So, I mean, we've had several sessions where I've just like yelled and cried and just expressed my utter frustration and hurt and abandonment. And, you know, he really just has been such a good sport through all of this and feels horrible and is just really like played along and helped me. Part of me feels really bad making a documentary that's going to make him seem like a horrible dad when he was actually like really great for like growing up and really invested in my filmmaking. So I do feel bad that my dad has been so supportive of all my filmmaking and everything so long. And I'm just really like, you know, dragging him across the
both things can be true, Catherine. Don't worry about it. It's okay. So this organization, WASP, and the schools are seem to be run by these underqualified ne'er-do-wells. And that's maybe sometimes putting it kindly. At the top is Robert Litchfield. And you can't interview him because he's somewhere. We don't know where. But you do get a beat on his brother, the unbelievably named Narvin Litchfield. And you're able to find him out of all things a karaoke night. Why did he think you were there with cameras? Did he think you were doing a documentary about karaoke?
I think so.
Because he was playing to the camera.
It was wild. That was a wild night. I can't believe it happened. Well, first of all, he's so public on social and it was crazy. So he just posts, hey, I'm doing karaoke Wednesdays at 8. And so I tell my producers, like, we're going to karaoke. And I immediately just start thinking of a list of what songs I'm going to sing. So I'm like, Every Breath You Take, you know, Blondie's One Way or Another. And so my producers, of course, are like, wow, we don't, like, this is crazy. I was like, trust me.
Unlike the Justice Department or FBI, there's nothing I can really do to the Litchfields, except this. But don't get too comfortable, Narvin. Because one way or another, I'm gonna get you.
And I don't know, like, maybe I am crazy. All of this has felt like a fever dream, but I was like, we're not gonna get any sort of satisfying confrontation, and I don't want to give him a platform to like spew his bullshit. So I was like, it's funnier just to make fun of him. So let's just do it this way. He shows up. So we put just signs everywhere saying, hey, we're filming in here. And anyone who came in the room, my producers are at the door, be like, hey, we're actually filming the karaoke tonight. So if you're okay with that, just sign a release. Every single person signed a release. No one. So Narvin comes in. We're like, this is the big moment. He takes it, just signs it, doesn't even read it. I think it says the program as the company of release on it or something. He signs it without even looking. And we're like, I can't believe this is actually happening. But he's such a narcissist. So he's just like, of course people are filming. Also, did he realize like, the cameras were really only filming him and not other people. Yeah. It was like him and me, but he was loving it. He was eating it up.
Did you do a duet with him? Because at one point we see you on stage with him.
Did it? Oh, yeah. Oh, I was like, I'm going to milk this for all it's worth. So I went up there. I started dancing behind him. There's actually a really great photo on my conspiracy board of Narvin singing and me right behind him going like, ah, and it was perfect. And I was like, you know, I'm not law enforcement. I can't put him in jail. I can't do anything. This is all I really can do is just sing Blondie at him and make him look like a fool, which for a narcissist is like the best kind of punishment they can get is just being made fun of. So
yeah, well, we see you singing One Way or Another by Blondie. Were you happy with that song selection ultimately?
Yeah, no, I think that worked. I was going on, I was going back and forth for a while about what would be the best song, but that one worked.
Yeah. So I have a question. You know, if a parent came to you and said, hey, you know, I watched your doc, I have a teen in crisis. I don't know what to do. It's not going to be a TTI program, clearly. What do you think they can do instead? Or is there just not a single answer to that question?
There's not a single answer. And I think that is the problem, or the reason why these programs exist, is because they pretend there is a single answer. And there just, there simply is not. Every child is different. Every circumstances is different. These places try to sell themselves as a one-stop shop, one size fits all, towards treating a variety of behavioral issues in children. And that just doesn't exist. Like, okay, you're telling me you take someone like Nikki and the doc, who was a heroin addict, someone like me who had Mike's Hard Lemonade, and put them in the same place for a year and the same treatment for both of us? Like, that's bananas. It's ridiculous. And also, just long-term residential treatment in general is rarely necessary. Rarely necessary. If residential treatment is needed at all, it's usually short-term. And these places, I mean, it's just insane that you don't even need to commit a crime. You don't get a trial or jury or sentencing. You don't know how long you're going to be there, but you can just be kept indefinitely in a worse than prison circumstances for not even doing anything. But if a parent came to me being like, what do you need? I mean, I love Phil Ellberg, the lawyer I talked to in there way back years ago. He was like, I just say, don't do this, you know? And he actually gave me a different answer when I interviewed, because I had first interviewed him back in like 2010. And then when I re-interviewed him in 2022 or three, he gave me a more detailed answer. He's like, I would ask, like, well, tell me about the kid. Tell me about all the, it's just, give me more details, because it's going to be a different plan for each kid. And I should get his full thing, because he said it much more eloquently. But that's the thing, is there's not going to be one simple answer. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. There's no magical place you can just send a kid off and a year later they come back to you being a perfect kid. It's the same way as like getting a puppy and being like, I'm gonna send my puppy off to get trained. No, as a puppy, you have to, as the owner, be trained of how to like be consistent with the puppy. Like, it just doesn't work that way. There's no magical place you can send your kid off to and get something, a robot back. Or that's what you will get back, is a robot with complex PTSD.
Well, the program Cons, Cults, and Kidnapping, I got to be honest, it's one of the most extraordinary first-person investigations I've ever seen. It is truly, truly great. Director Kathryn Kubler, thank you so much for telling me all about how you made it. It was such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. You too.
That's it for this week's episode. Thanks again to Kathryn Kubler. For more of my takes, check out my other podcast, Crime Writers On. Each week on that show, we break down the latest in true crime documentaries, TV shows, podcasts, and pop culture. If you like You Can't Make This Up, please rate and review this show and share it with your friends. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. And make sure to follow the show to stay tuned for all new episodes. You Can't Make This Up is a production of Netflix. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. Thanks so much for listening.